Welcome to the first episode of Building Back Better. This podcast series examines some of the good things that have come out of the COVID-19 experience, particularly as they relate to work in the community services sector. I'm Antonia Mockin and I'll be your host for the series. I currently work as General Manager Community and External Relations at Uniting Vic Tas, one of the largest community service agencies in both Victoria and Tasmania in Australia. We run a broad range of services, all with the purpose of inspiring people, enlivening communities and confronting injustice. This goes from early learning to aged care and just about everything in between. Obviously, COVID's been transformational for us. In just a few days, we took as much of our work online as was possible. At the same time, demand started going up and hasn't really stopped. A significant proportion of our workforce had to stay in their frontline positions, a cause in itself of stress and anxiety. We had to completely rethink how we delivered services. In quite a few cases, it has had unexpected positives. Many more people fulfilling appointments when they're online, or us being able to reach into rural communities that had struggled before. In other areas, it's been very challenging, such as in supported independent living for people with disability and out-of-home care for vulnerable young people. As an organisation, we're thinking about how can we build back better? What's our new normal going to be? In this series, we'll be looking at some of the key issues that can help us answer those questions. We'll talk to experts about what offices will look like in the future. We'll find out how local communities have changed. We'll explore the changed relationship with our urban centres. We're kicking off with a discussion about the future of work. This is a topic that's been the subject of academic interest for some time. It has a special resonance for me as I spent some time working with the Centre for Workplace Leadership at the University of Melbourne, including on their Future of Work conference. I recently sat down to talk about how our ideas on the future of work have been changed by the pandemic. I talked to Michaela Cronin and Josh Healy. I'll get them to introduce themselves.
My name is Michaela Cronin. I'm the director of the Future Social Service Institute, which is a partnership between RMIT University and the Victorian Council of Social Services. We're really very much focused on working with to support the community sector around workforce issues. So very interested in this conversation. Thank you very much for inviting me, Antonia.
Great. Do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hi, Antonia. Well, yes, I've worked in a few roles, including at the University of Melbourne. I'm about to take up a position actually as a senior lecturer at the University of Newcastle in New South Wales. So I'm moving to that role in January. But my research interests sort of cut broadly across the future of work and labour and employment relations. So I've been doing work looking at, for instance, the platform economy and gig work, the ageing workforce and older workers' experiences, and sort of aspects of technological change and automation and the future of work. So thank you to you for organising this. Really looking forward to the discussion.
Yeah, really glad to have you both here. So perhaps, Josh, you mentioned about your interest in technological change. And I guess for most of us, the big change that has happened in our life has been technological, particularly if we're listening to a podcast, I guess. So what did we know or think we knew about the future of work and about the impact of technology on our lives before COVID? And has that changed at all by the experience that we've lived through?
Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah. So, I mean, technology was very much at the center of discussions about the future of work. There were other things in the mix, but the main part of the narrative, as I read it, was really that the machines were coming, that artificial intelligence and robots were sort of starting to encroach on all sorts of new areas of work, and that pretty soon the workforce was going to be transformed. The consequence was going to be that a lot of jobs were going to go. Many more were probably in some way going to be transformed. And if we were lucky, some new jobs would be created along the way, and just what they might look like was anybody's guess. We thought we knew based on past episodes of change, including, you know, computerization and earlier phases of digitization. We knew that there would be uneven impacts, that some classes of workers and some occupations would be harder hit by the change. And you were most exposed or most at risk if you were in sort of routine type jobs and what economists like to call non-cognitive jobs. So that is jobs where you didn't have to use your brain too much, and where what you were doing was punching through a sequence of processes that could be automated. So those jobs were at risk. If you weren't doing that kind of work, and including if you were doing the kind of work that was very human-centered, that needed a lot of person-to-person sort of social contact and interaction, then you were likely to be comparatively safer. And those who were at risk would need to learn new skill sets if they wanted to stay in the workforce, if they wanted to keep up with the machines. We were told that they would need to become better at communicating, more intuitive, more empathetic, more of all these sorts of things that some people are innately good at and some are not. So there was a new skill set to be learned. And I suppose coming to the issue of COVID, well, I think a lot of that's been thrown a big spanner in the works, let's put it that way. I was thinking about this and thinking that in none of the prior discourse about future of work, this transformation by global pandemic, it wasn't on anybody's radar. So that aspect of the change has really been a very unexpected one. And I take it as a reminder that, you know, the future of work is ultimately unpredictable. We need to be somewhat humble in making any forecasts about, you know, what future of work is likely to come. And we can get blindsided by developments like the coronavirus that nobody really saw coming. In terms of what's changed, well, I mean, a huge change, of course, is around working from home. Prior to the pandemic, the University of Melbourne's been tracking Australians' patterns of working from home for about 20 years. And prior to the pandemic, it had never been more than 10% of work hours that were done at home. And obviously now that number has dramatically increased. So that's a big change that we didn't see coming. And I think you could put an optimistic spin on it. You could say that we're going to be challenged in other ways in the future, most pressingly, I suspect, by climate change. And, you know, one takeaway from COVID is that we can pivot quickly if we do so under the threat of a common external influence, or if we've got a kind of unison purpose, unity of purpose, we can pivot, and we may need to do that again.
Michaela, Josh mentioned pivoting there. I think all of us in the community services sector have done quite a lot of pivoting in the last 8 to 8, 9 months. What are some of the innovations you've been hearing of from the sector as it's had to adapt to this completely new environment?
I don't think I've had one conversation over the last 6, 9 months that pivot isn't mentioned at least once. I think the sense has been that just about everybody has been very open to, I mean, we had to move very fast, right? March, if you think back to, it was the weekend of the Grand Prix, and there was that, are we, aren't we, you know, are we going home, aren't we? And there was a couple of weeks of, you know, some people still being in denial. And I remember packing up my desk and, you know, just grabbing a couple of things fairly, when we look back, fairly naively, actually, about what was happening and what the implications were going to be. And I think what I think is absolutely extraordinary is the speed with which organisations in the community sector adapted, and adapted very much with the energy around what everybody referred to as being united behind a common purpose, which was all about serving the communities that we work with. And the things that happened quickly were previously a bit like the way Josh talks about, you know, what we thought about working from home. Really early on, everyone, there was a lot of, oh no, we were not going to be able to do that. It's just not possible to do that. And then you would see change happening overnight. One of the examples very early on, I was having conversations with you know, some of the peak bodies around what were they concerned about? What were they thinking about? What their pressure points were going to be? A lot of the conversation was around the need for a surge workforce as everybody watched what was happening, you know, particularly in Italy and Europe around very rapid need for that person-to-person care, the care kind of work of, you know, in hospitals, in aged care, in disability, in residential settings. People were very anxious about what they were going to need. And I think one of the other things that has really transformed across the board, but, you know, particularly in thinking about that surge workforce and thinking about transitioning people now, thinking about transitioning people from parts of the economy where jobs have disappeared into the parts of the economy where there are still great need. And as Josh said, that's very much the care, you know, the industries that are person to person, where we know there is really significant demand still. And I was talking to an organisation yesterday that they were saying they've got 30%. They've still got, even in this environment, they've got 30% vacancies in positions. How do we do that fast? So much more recognition of skill sets. How do we rapidly build up people's skill sets? And one of the ones we talked about early on was first aid. How do you get people trained up right? What are the things, if you're thinking from an emergency point of view about what are we going to need these people, what are the basic things we're going to need these people to be able to do? First aid was one of them. And one of the early conversations I had in March, in those couple of weeks, as we were all kind of coming to terms with going to remote delivery, and the providers all said, can't be done, can't do it, you can't do it online, simply not possible. You need to have, you know, face-to-face, you need to watch people, you need, you know, you need observation of their practice. And I went, and then I moved on to something else, and I went back 2 weeks later, and they'd done it. The whole course was online, and it was being delivered by, you know, a number of providers, and they'd moved really fast. And there was a very strong sense of that having a common purpose. And it's one of the things that I think really stands out about the community sector. We did a piece of research in collaboration with VCOS that was looking at the adaptations that have occurred. And it's very clear that some of the value that I think is not recognised necessarily sometimes by government is that the community sector are very well hooked into local communities. They listen. They're like what happened with the lockdown of the residential towers in Flemington. When they realised it was community sectors who came in and knew how to support and work with those communities and understand what their needs were. And the community organisations, I know I've spoken to a number of the CEOs, they were called on a Sunday morning and they had teams there on the Sunday afternoon to help. So rapid shifting online, often digitally, being very purpose-driven and prepared to be flexible about a whole range of things that we thought would never change.
Josh, we haven't all been working from home, but many of us have. And it's changed our relationships with our colleagues and our employers. We've had a window into each other's personal lives. We've seen pets, children, partners, dirty dishes. It's probably fair to say that for those of us that have been working this way, it's fundamentally changed our view of work. What do you think we've learned from this great working from home experiment?
I think on the positive side, working from home has given people some of the benefits that we were long told were there to be seized from flexible work, right? I mean, the boosters of flexible work, this has been the agenda for decades with neoliberalism, flexible work, more, you know, more part-time, more casual work. We were told that this would free people up to have better control over how they use their time. And I think the lucky among us have sort of realised that ambition, being able to, you know, work at the times of day that work best for us rather than the times of day that happen to work best for the clock. I think that's been a big plus for many people. Obviously, as you sort of intimated at the beginning, at the intro of this, you know, many of us have responsibilities that go beyond what we're paid to do in our jobs, and those things need to be managed and understood and kind of configured around our work responsibilities. And I'd like to think that, you know, the more enlightened employers and managers out there, by virtue of, you know, having had this window onto people's working lives and kind of virtually stepping into their private sphere, now have an understanding about those other things that people need to manage. And it'd be great if, you know, whatever new normal, and I hesitate to say that, I'm doing that in sort of scare quotations, whatever new normal we move towards, that it will include, you know, more scope for people to take care of those obligations rather than treat them as second order concerns that have to come down the list behind all their work duties. So I think that there's definite positives there to be seen. On the other hand, I think, you know, the negatives include, you know, a further kind of slippage in the boundaries between our work and non-work lives. That is problematic for many people. And one thing about being able to go into the workplace, into the office for a designated span of hours is that you know that by and large your time is going to be your own outside of those hours. And I know that, you know, with mobile phones and the internet, you know, there's this bleed through of time, work time into the non-work sphere. But, you know, the more of us who are working from home, the more likely we are to have to kind of contend with these sorts of issues and erect boundaries of sorts that mean that we don't just give over voluntarily too much of our own time to work commitments. It can be a kind of a false economy, if you like, this imagination that we're getting more done when we're really kind of running ourselves down. The other point I'd make at the end is really just around who doesn't get to work from home. And, you know, of course, we know that there's been this massive spike in working from home among the professional classes, but not everybody can do that. And we can't neglect that that sizable segment of the workforce where, you know, it's not likely anytime soon that they'll be working from home. And so sort of what does that mean? One implication of not having such a large number of people en masse in our CBDs is that some of the work in the service economy is kind of dried up, that all these cafes and restaurants that used to service the downtown lunchtime crowd, there's been much less demand for that, and casual workers in department stores and so on. So, you know, working from home, it's easy to just think about the experience of those that are doing it and what does it mean for them, but there are significant spillover effects, if you will, to the rest of the economy as well.
Yeah, and I think particularly, well, because we're focusing on the community services sector, that's been an issue certainly within our organisation, that there are certain roles, disability support workers, people providing home care for older people, early learning workers, yeah, who haven't had that possibility. And of course, in a pandemic, that was quite stressful and anxiety inducing. Michaela, have you been talking to people in the industry about that and about whether we risk creating a new divide within the community services sector, those that can work from home and those that can't?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's probably a couple of points that I'd like to add. This is kind of fascinating thinking about the changing nature of the relationship between employers and employees. And I think one of the others that's been really highlighted in this time, and for a lot of that work, part of the workforce that you're talking about, Antonia, is the impact of insecure work has been brought to the fore and talked about in the public domain in a way that it's not usually. You know, I mean, we've had, it's been because of the impact of people who had to cobble together multiple jobs to be able to make an adequate living, meaning that they were moving between multiple facilities, actually came to the fore. I remember one time, because we were talking about this and I beforehand, so I think some of these things are not issues that we didn't know about. They've just actually been magnified very significantly, and B, they're actually more visible now because of the impact on the broader community around those issues.
With COVID-19, one of the big changes is that more of our services have had to go online that were previously delivered in person. Michaela, have you been seeing a difference? Is this something that we can perhaps capture for the future?
What we're hearing, and there's a real need to build the evidence around this, is not, you know, it's pretty anecdotal and, you know, it's not terribly, there's not a whole lot of evidence, yeah. But that some people, for some interactions, for some services, some interventions, it's actually preferable to do things digitally online in a way that service providers would never have accepted or acknowledged before. People who, you know, might not be able to access services because they've got kids at home or they've got agoraphobia or whatever it is. Increasingly, we had one lovely example talking to a community health centre up, and it was a, you know, as remote as Victoria gets, which is not as remote as right other parts of the country. But she was talking about health services provided, and the example she gave was getting a bloke to do an older bloke who acknowledged he was, when he did the appointment, it was a diabetes, really significant diabetes. He was driving the tractor while he was doing the assessment, and he said, yeah, I would have never come in. I would have never, you know, so... There's some absolutely fabulous examples of people getting services that probably wouldn't have.
That's a great example. I mean, we've talked about some of the perhaps unexpected benefits of this move into an online distance world, but of course it hasn't all been positive.
One of the things I've observed is leaders in, you know, in my own organisation, but in other organisations, really being prepared to talk about and make time for and think through what it is it that we've lost being all in the office together, you know, in terms of all the incidental interactions, all of the things that give people, you know, a bit of downtime, or you're able to observe how someone's traveling, and put in, a lot of organisations put in place some really, and I know Uniting did amongst a number of the others, some really impressive strategies around thinking about people's mental health at work. And it was very democratised. It wasn't just, you know, those people, you know, a recognition that there's always a small component of your workforce that will have mental health issues. Just about everybody at some point in time has struggled through the pandemic. So I think that's really useful. I think at the same time as with the Royal Commission into Mental Health, there is a much greater current preparedness to talk about mental health and what might need to happen around caring for people.
I'd like to ask you both, from your own personal experience and the insights and the people you've been talking to and what you've seen around, what do you think is the most important thing that you want to hold on to from what we've been through over the last few months? I'll start with you, Josh.
Well, I think sort of in a way to reiterate a small point I made earlier on, it's about part of the takeaway for me is around the feasibility of change and the importance of our society and our social institutions and our organisations in kind of driving change and managing change. I mean, a lot of this discourse that we had around future of work was, as we academics say, somewhat deterministic. The idea that new technology was coming and inevitably everything would change. I mean, technology is an important influence on the way things get done, but it doesn't change things of its own accord. It requires a kind of response. Managers have to decide to take up new technology. Governments have to decide in what ways they're going to regulate it. Decisions are made across the whole society by individuals and by families and by communities about how things are going to get done. And the COVID experience has been very much of that kind, except it hasn't been about technology. It's been about a response to a novel coronavirus. And again, we've seen that, you know, governments have acted where necessary. There's been, you know, at least in Victoria, a very high degree of public support for the measures and kind of compliance with the measures, even though they're painful and they're onerous and they really restrict our lives. There's been an understanding that this is necessary and we have to do it. And I remember going out for a walk when it was still possible to do that, and you know, the city was deserted and places were shut and there were no automobiles on the road. And it was like we'd returned the city to nature. And I was just struck by the sudden scale of the change that had come about by virtue of our responses to this threat and the kind of commonality of purpose that we felt, at least for that period of time, in seeing off that threat and in dealing with it. So I suppose I really take something kind of positive out of that. So that's message one. And the other part, which is a bit separate from that is much more around, I think, what is going to happen to jobs in the future and what we can learn from the COVID experience. And I think what it reinforces for me is that, you know, human jobs, jobs that are done by people rather than by robots, aren't going away anytime soon. So, you know, a big part of the discourse has been around, you know, the end of work and the disappearance of work. But we've seen that there are a whole host of essential classes of worker that have been doing the necessary stuff when the rest of us have been sort of sheltering in place at home and working from home and Zooming and kind of going crazy, keeping our feet out of the way of the kids. There's been a class of workers that has been out there doing what's necessary. It's not been robots that have been doing it. It's not robots that have been sort of wiping down the pedestrian crossing buttons. It's not robots that have been staffing aged care facilities and hospitals. You know, it's not robots that have been delivering food and meals and beverages to people in their homes. This is all stuff that's been done by people. And we now need to move from what I think we've got at the moment, which is a much clearer recognition of the importance of these jobs and these people, you know, an understanding and an appreciation of their existence and the risks of insecure work that Michaela's talked about. We need to move from that to actually rewarding people, valuing these jobs, understanding that they are often precarious, poorly paid jobs, even though they're essential jobs. So there's this big paradox there, I think, around the reality that's been revealed, the fact that we need these people and there are no robots coming to do their jobs anytime soon, and the fact that they're still, by and large, less well remunerated, less well valued, less well recognized kinds of jobs. So I'd love to see us seize that moment to elevate those people and those jobs to a higher plane.
Michaela, what do you hope we'll keep from 2020?
Yeah, look, I'd actually really pretty much like to echo what Josh has talked about. I think the recognition of the ability to change, but putting at the centre of that the health and well-being. I mean, I think taking a well-being approach to, you know, the governance community decision-making, that's been at the centre of our decision-making, and that would be fantastic if that stays. Things like the creation of a government-funded sick leave payments for the casualised workforce so that they didn't have to go and work when they were sick, you know. Stuff like that. One of the other examples that really struck me early on was there was the Aboriginal Forum that was established identified that there was a real issue for Aboriginal children in engagement in schooling from home because they didn't have access to the technology. They predominantly didn't have computers, internet. And that happened overnight. It's not like we didn't know that before. It's not like we didn't know that Aboriginal children or children who were disadvantaged for a range of reasons had unequal access to technology, and people had been advocating for that before, but it happened overnight when there was suddenly the drivers of decision making was community wellbeing, not whether or not we've got it, whether it's in the budget or whether or not we've got how big a deficit we're going to have. So that for me, having change being driven by community wellbeing would be the first one. And the other is this issue around the other thing I'd really like to not get forgotten is the comments have been made about we need to deal with the impact of the insecure workforce that is doing some of our most important, as Josh said before, work in the community, caring for our most vulnerable when they most need it. The people who are doing that are not adequately trained, remunerated, supported, and that has to change. And there's been a recognition of that, and I would really like to see that followed through on.
Well, thanks to you both for a really fascinating conversation. Let's see what it all brings and whether we are really able to learn the lessons and take the positives out of the experience that we've just had. Thanks to you both.
All the best. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks.
See ya.
Thanks.
See ya.
So that's it for our first episode. I hope you found it thought-provoking, interesting. Please feel free to drop us a message, leave a comment, send us your thoughts. Any ideas you've got for future topics would be really great. And look forward to the next one. Thanks. Bye.